Thank you. Good morning. I'm Alexis Strauss-Hacker. I'm chair of the San Francisco Bay Regional Water Quality Control Board. Welcome to today's board meeting. Our meetings are hybrid, so in addition to those of you here in person, we may also receive public comment through our Zoom meeting platform. If you're not physically present and want to comment, you need to be in the Zoom meeting space and not watching through the webcast. If you haven't already received a link for the Zoom meeting, you can visit our website and register through the link on the agenda for today's meeting. After you register, you'll receive a Zoom login link providing access to our meeting. If you're in person and wish to speak, you may also register online or with the assistance from our team at the registration table just outside, so we know to call on you. For those in the Zoom meeting, you'll be muted until it's your turn to speak. Our staff will then promote you, so please unmute yourself so that we can hear you. When you're done speaking and the board members have completed asking any questions they may have, you'll be placed back on mute. For those in the room here waiting to speak, you'll be called by name. Please come to the podium so we can best see and hear you. All speakers will be given 3 minutes for comment. Please state your name and your affiliate organization, if applicable, when called upon. Thank you for joining us today. We look forward to a good meeting. And I'd like to ask Julie Haas, our board clerk, to call the roll.
Good morning, everyone. Can you hear me?
Yes.
All right. Board Member Ransom.
Here.
Board Member Beelen.
Here.
Board Member Batty is absent. Board Member Gunther.
Here.
Board Member Kissinger is absent. Vice Chair Young.
Here.
Chair Hacker.
Here.
Thank you.
Thank you. We have a quorum physically present for today's meeting and welcome everyone. This next item on our agenda, item 2, is the public forum. I'd like to open our meeting to the public forum and remind everyone the public forum is for items that are not on the agenda today. Those items on the agenda, you can speak at the appropriate time. Items that are not a pending or an impending matter, meaning they're not about to come up on our agenda in the next few months. Please consult our board clerk, Julie Haas, who's seated here in the front of the auditorium, if you have any questions. I'll call on each of our public speakers who've registered to speak under the public forum portion now. One additional note, if you're remote and haven't been called, please raise your virtual hand on the Zoom platform by clicking on the reactions icon on your screen and then on the raised hand icon. That way we'll know to call on you. Again, each speaker is given 3 minutes. Will be timed and notified via the online timer visible on the screen. So thank you for your participation and understanding. Julie, do we have any public forum registrations?
No public forum registrations.
Are there any Zoom participants waiting to speak?
Nope.
Is there anyone in the room who'd like to speak in public forum? Seeing none, we appreciate your attention to this part of the agenda and would like to move on to item 3, the minutes of our June 11th board meeting. Included in our board packets and posted online are the draft minutes from our last board meeting. Do we have any edits or revisions to those minutes? Do we have anyone from the public who may wish to comment?
We do not.
Very well. May I please have a motion and a second to adopt the June minutes?
So moved.
Moved by Vice Chair. Seconded by?
Second.
By Board Member Beelen. Julie, could you please call the vote?
Board Member Ransom.
Abstain.
Board Member Beelen.
Aye.
Board Member Gunther.
Aye.
Vice Chair Young.
Aye.
And Chair Hacker.
Aye. Thank you. The June 11th board meeting minutes have been adopted by the board. Item 4 are our board member and executive officer reports, followed by the board members first and then executive officer. Do we have Sean joining us today? So I'd like to welcome Sean McGuire, our liaison from the State Water Resources Control Board, for his updates. Sean, welcome.
Good morning, Chair Hacker and members of the board. It's good to see you. I haven't been able to provide an update to you for a couple of meetings now, so I'm glad to be back here. I think I always lead off with a broad statement that there's a lot going on, and that's true here as well. But I tried to distill down just a couple of key updates for you today. And one is the positive news that we have a state budget. The governor signed the budget last week. And one of the things that typically happens then in that process is going through an assessment of what that means for the state water board and for the regional water quality control boards. We're going through that process now, and we'll have some further updates for you. But there have been, you know, as you know, there is a budget deficit. So we are in challenging financial times as a state. And that has had impacts. And you may recall last year, the governor asking for a sweep of vacant positions across the state, as well as some other budget adjustments. That's impacted all agencies, including the regional water board and the state board. So we'll see. We don't have the final details on that yet, but I think that will be coming soon. Other than that, I don't believe that there are other significant impacts at this time, but I, like I said, I'll come back when I have a deeper dive into any budget changes as they affect your board. I do want to also flag through that process, through the budget process, as you're, I'm sure, aware, there's often a trailer bill package associated with that. That's no exception this year. The one I wanted to highlight for you is a trailer bill proposed by the administration that would include a CEQA exemption for water quality control planning. And that would include water quality control plans that are adopted by the state board as well as the regional boards. That was included in the budget package. The legislature wanted to spend a little bit more time considering that and the implications of that type of action. And so they pulled that out of the budget package, but it's still up for negotiation discussion, so that could still happen. And I just wanted to have that on your radar screen. What it would mean at a high level is a quicker process generally, in that there would be fewer CEQA compliance requirements associated with planning. So it could be helpful in a number of cases in streamlining some of our processes and actions. And we'll see what happens through that discussion in the legislature. When it comes to state policy, so the biggest action, the biggest game in town, and one of our highest priorities at the moment is, as you know, and I've mentioned many times, the Bay Delta Water Quality Control Plan. So that continues to move forward. And I bring this to your attention because we should be seeing a revised draft of that Water Quality Control Plan this summer. And that will kick off then the process. This will be the second second revised draft. And that will kick off an extensive public input process to hopefully complete that plan in the very near future. So I wanted to get that on your radar. That will, I'm sure, generate a lot of input and interest when that updated draft comes out. The other area I wanted to mention briefly to you today is when it comes to funding. So despite the budget challenges and the situation that we're in there, we are actually in a pretty good place at the moment when it comes to funding for drinking water and wastewater infrastructure projects. We still have a number of funding sources, including federal funding, and also with the addition of Proposition 4, some state bond funds and other funds from prior actions that are all still available. And so we're in the process right now of going through the intended use plan, which is our annual process to allocate those available funds for loans and for grants to systems and entities that are eligible for that type of funding. And so this year we're in the middle of the process, anticipating that the August 5th board meeting will be the adoption of that plan. So we're still looking at comments that we received on the draft, but the current staff recommendation is for about $950 million in new loans for clean water projects. So that's a pretty high level. We have also about $450 million available for small community wastewater grants and over $200 million available for our water recycling grant program. So this is one of those that we have, we often, sometimes there's lean years, sometimes there's stronger years when it comes to funding. I would put this in one of the stronger year categories. So it's a good problem to have. The needs still, as always, typically outweigh the amount of funding that we have, even though it sounds like we have a lot. It's still a challenge, and we have to make tough decisions at times in terms of what projects we fund and the amount that we fund for those different types of projects. But I just wanted to flag that for you so you're aware. And those are all the updates I had noted to share with you today. But as always, happy to answer any questions on those topics or any other topics that might be of interest to you.
Thank you so much. The calendar for consideration of trailer bills, like budget trailer bills, does that go through August? Or when would one know the fate of some of those, for example, what you mentioned with regard to CEQA?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think any bills would need to be signed by, I believe it's mid-September. So I think in the next month or two would be the timeline for that. I'm sure there's some intermediate deadlines there, which I'm not as familiar with, but can always circle back with you on that.
So much. Board members may have follow-up comments or questions. If not, we know that State Board has much on its plate in July and August, and we really appreciate you being able to join us today. Thank you, Sean.
Great. Thank you. Good to see you all. Take care.
All right. Let's turn to board member reports. Board Member Gunther.
I just want to point out to everybody that in the face of the month of rain that fell in a day in Texas and continues to happen, the federal government's responded by basically eliminating our policy actions that have been adopted to address climate change. So the federal government is now, policy is to expand and make as durable as possible the long-term use of fossil fuels in the United States and around the world. And so I think that we are facing a situation in which our government's purpose is to exacerbate the problems associated with climate change that we are now observing, and I think this will have a long-term impact on our region and every other part of the country. And it behooves us now then to think even more diligently than before about how we are going to be able to maintain our resilience in the face of these changes that are coming, because this is just adding to fuel to the problems that are already occurring. And we will, this kind of problem will come to us as well. The whole idea of a month of rain in a day implies the certain average rainfall per month, but that's, you know, that's obviously changing. And so I hope that all of us can, whenever we have the opportunity, can point out that we're simply lost at the federal level in terms of addressing the problems facing our country and the world, and it's going to be up to us to really lead the way.
Thank you. Board Member Beelen.
Nothing.
Very well.
Just very brief, just to let you know, I was able to make contact with the representative at ABAG. So I will be attending their meeting on July 17th in San Francisco.
Thanks so much. Yep. We look forward to hearing back.
Thanks.
Vice Chair Young.
Nothing for me. Thank you.
One quick note before I turn to our executive officer. Every month, the chairs of the 9 regional boards have a meeting with the State Water Board executive director and the senior management team. When we met this week, we talked about an important study underway hosted by State Board with UCLA's Leskin Center to try and inventory statewide what the wastewater needs are. And it is a 4-year endeavor that is underway, and State Board has received the first 2-year study, and some of the regional board managers may have seen it, I'm not sure. But I just want to call attention to it because it means that later this year, we would be able to have a public discussion of what the statewide wastewater needs may be. And then the second phase of the project from this year forward to 2027 looks at what some of the most critical needs and problems and potential solutions may be. I think that that study, which happens and has happened for decades, but is a far more vigorous and deeper dive this time, will be of great interest, and I'm hopeful that we'll be able to have an informational item in the future and that it will be useful to those of you who are interested in this. There is a companion piece that is somewhat outside our orbit. There's both a drinking water needs assessment and a wastewater needs assessment. They both happen in each state, but I'm just struck this time by how I think it will be comprehensive and interesting and inform how infrastructure funds may be awarded in the years to come. So I thought that was a fascinating discussion. There is information on this on the State Board's website and also on UCLA Leskin Center website. And let me turn to our executive officer.
Thank you, Chair Hacker and members of the board. It's always wonderful to share with you and the public the positive work and the results of the Regional Water Board team. I just want to point out that the first item in the July Executive Officer Report is a wonderful example of the diligence of our team to improve water quality. As you saw in the report, both PCBs and mercury in discharges to the bay are far below the regulatory allocations. We continue to monitor for trends so that we can work with our discharges to mitigate any growing concerns or negative impacts. But right now, things are trending in the right direction. And I just want to say thank you to our team for the work to get us here, for the sharing the detail in the report, and to each of you, our board members, for adopting the TMDLs for PCBs and mercury that helped drive these results. Next, kind of as a follow-on to Andy's comments about climate change, we're real excited about another aquifer storage and recovery project happening in the northern part of our region. In May, we shared the work of the Aquifer Storage and Recovery Project in Sonoma Valley. And this month in the Executive Officer's Report, we included detail on the Aquifer Storage Pilot in Petaluma. We're very excited and cautiously optimistic about these aquifer storage and recovery projects, knowing that they will really help with drought resilience and sustainable water management as we think about climate change and address climate change in the future. And then finally, just want to let everyone know that 2025, this year, marks the 75th anniversary of the creation of the 9 regional water boards. And along with you, our dedicated and committed board members, I want to recognize the work of our staff and our partners who have been working diligently throughout these last 75 years to protect, enhance, and restore the Bay Area's water resources for protection of the environment, public health, and all beneficial uses. On a more somber note, I want to take a few minutes to recognize a very special scientist, Mike Connor, who passed away on June 10th. Mike dedicated his career to protecting water quality and the environment, and he spent many years working to protect the waters of San Francisco Bay. Mike was the executive director of the San Francisco Estuary Institute, also known as SFEI, from 2002 to 2008. And under his leadership, SFEI expanded their work in support of developing sound science for essential decision making. After leading SFEI for many years, Mike moved on to lead the East Bay Discharges Association, also known as EBDA, which is a joint powers public agency made up of the City of San Leandro, Oraloma Sanitary District, Castro Valley Sanitary District, City of Hayward, and Union Sanitary District. As EPDED's general manager, Mike once again advocated for sound science for effective policymaking and decision-making. I personally have fond memories being on the board of the Bay Area Clean Water Agencies, also known as BACWA, with Mike and the other board members. Mike came to each board meeting well-prepared with thoughtful analysis of all the board materials, the graphs, the charts, and every report. As a key member of the BACWA board, Mike continued to advocate for sound science with practical and cost-effective solutions. Mike was also instrumental working with the other Bay Area wastewater leaders to collect data on the amount of money each wastewater agency was spending on sodium bisulfite to dechlorinate the treated effluent to San Francisco Bay. Since the regulations required instantaneous 0.0 chlorine residual on wastewater discharges to the bay, each of the wastewater agencies was overdosing and overspending on sodium bisulfite to avoid any violations from the Regional Water Board. Mike worked with the other BACWA leaders to compile and present information to the regional board and spearheaded the effort to change the regulation from 0.0 instantaneous chlorine residual to 1-hour average based on continuous monitoring. This win-win solution, championed by Mike, allowed the wastewater operators in the Bay Area to stop overdosing sodium bisulfite, which is better for the environment and better for the ratepayer. This is just one example of Mike's focus on doing the right thing for the public and the environment. Last but not least, Mike was a key member of the San Francisco Bay Nutrient Management Program. Like the BACWA board members, Mike participated in each of the nutrient meetings with insight and analysis of the technical reports, ready to engage in passionate discussions on the monitoring and modeling results. He was passionate that the science must drive future regulations. I have vivid memories of my walk around Lake Merritt with Mike in August of 2022 as we observed the lake covered with dead fish from the harmful algae bloom. We both agreed on the value of the Regional Water Board, the BACWA community, and the many other stakeholders' commitment to studying the impacts of nutrients on the bay. And we were feeling fortunate that we had science to inform regulatory decisions. Mike was a friend and colleague to many. He will be missed, and he will be remembered for his legacy of protecting water quality and the environment. Thank you.
Thank you, Eileen, for that observation of his many contributions. Is there anything board members would like to comment or add? I have one follow-up question. At our last board meeting, we had a presentation from Luisa Valiela about the Bay Area grant funding, and at that point, the large tranche of that congressionally mandated award had not yet arrived. Do we have any update?
No, it hasn't arrived.
Okay.
Nothing more.
Okay. And you'll let us know when we hear anything further?
Yes.
Or, yeah, please.
Eileen, regarding the mercury and the PCB mass load, mercury mass loading, when I look at these graphs, they kind of look like I would expected 15 years ago that they would look. Where there's variation year to year, but there's really not much of a trend. I'm wondering if the staff agrees with that assessment.
I'd say yes, we agree with that assessment, and kind of as noted in the report, I think part of the variability is that it's not like we're taking the samples at the exact same time under the exact same conditions, so that's why we expect the variability in the data.
All right, shall we move? Okay. We're going to move on to agenda item 5, and I'm delighted that we have commenters here in person and look forward to hearing from you. But before we proceed, I need to administer the oath for today's hearing. All relevant evidence that any person desires to be considered by this board must be introduced at this hearing, first by the board staff, second by the discharger, third by the public agencies, and forth by any other interested parties. The board and board counsel may ask questions to clarify the testimony of a witness at any time. Cross-examination of any witness by others will be allowed following completion of direct testimony by all persons. Each person testifying will commence by stating their name, their affiliation, and whether they took the oath to tell the truth. The hearing will not be conducted according to technical rules of evidence. The board will accept any evidence or testimony that is reasonably relevant to the issues. All board files, exhibits, and agenda materials pertaining to this matter will be made part of the record of this process. Additional written material will be made part of the record at the discretion of this board. Those wishing to testify in the hearing will now rise or raise your hand. Do you promise to tell the truth?
I do.
Thank you. Eileen, would you continue with board item 5?
Yes, thank you, Chair Hacker. The San Francisco Bay Regional Water Board administers two conditional waivers for grazing operations, one for the Tomales Bay watershed and one for the Sonoma Creek and Napa River watersheds. The existing waivers have expired and need to be renewed. In addition, the program is being proposed for expansion to the Petaluma River watershed and to additional areas in Point Reyes National Seashore. Today, we will be conducting a public hearing for the board to consider adoption of two items. First, item 5A is a resolution adopting a California Environmental Quality Act initial study and subsequent negative declaration. And second, item 5B is the revised tentative order for a conditional waiver of waste discharge requirements for grazing operations in the North San Francisco Bay region. I want to introduce Renee LeClaire, an engineer and geologist in the planning division, who will be providing a presentation on the two items today. Thank you, Renee.
Good morning, Chair Hacker, members of the board. As Eileen said, my name is Renee LeClaire. I'm an engineering geologist in the planning division, and I have taken the oath. Today, I'm here to present two items for your consideration: a CEQA resolution and a revised tentative order for a conditional waiver of waste discharge requirements for grazing operations in the North San Francisco Bay region, which I'll refer to here as the conditional waiver. For simplicity, I'll be discussing these two items together in my presentation. Although this is a new proposed order, the conditional waiver requirements remain largely the same as the existing conditional waivers that regulate grazing operations in Tomales Bay watershed and in the Sonoma Creek and Napa River watersheds. The CEQA resolution and conditional waiver aim to combine regulated grazing operations into one order and expand the program to additional grazed watersheds in the North Bay. The presentation is divided into four parts. I'll provide a brief review of the current grazing program, discuss the elements of the new conditional waiver, summarize public comments and our responses, and answer questions. The current grazing program is comprised of two conditional waivers, one for the Tomales Bay watershed, adopted in 2008 and renewed twice, and one for the Sonoma Creek and Napa River watersheds, adopted in 2011 and also renewed twice. There are currently 133 enrollees in the grazing program on grazing operations spanning approximately 88,000 acres, with the majority located in the Tomales Bay watershed. The two existing waivers are components of the implementation plans for total maximum daily loads, or TMDLs, addressing sediment, pathogen, and mercury impairments in the Tomales Bay, Sonoma Creek, and Napa River watersheds. The new conditional waiver will renew the existing waivers and expand the regulated area to the Petaluma River watershed and to the west side of Point Reyes National Seashore, creating a single permit for the entire geographic area. The illustration on the right shows the geographic extent of the proposed conditional waiver by watershed. From west to east, or left to right, they are Point Reyes National Seashore and the Tomales Bay watershed, Petaluma River watershed, Sonoma Creek watershed, and Napa River watershed on the eastern or right-hand side. This geographic expansion implements the 2019 Petaluma River Bacteria TMDL and establishes consistent regulatory oversight of grazing operations throughout Point Reyes National Seashore that is consistent with the National Park Service's General Management Plan Amendment, and Water Quality Strategy for Managing Ranching Operations. The conditional waiver requirements will remain largely the same as the existing waivers. In addition to the geographic expansion and creation of a single permit for all grazing operations, conditional waiver updates include a uniform minimum acreage for enrollment of 100 acres, a new riparian corridor performance standard, and updates to forms and resources. I'll also note for members of the public that the conditional waiver is not a waiver of permit requirements, but rather is a type of permit that requires certain conditions be met in order to waive the need for waste discharge requirements, or WDRs, which is another type of permit. The potential environmental impacts of the Tomales Bay conditional waiver and the Napa-Sonoma conditional waiver were analyzed in CEQA documents that the board adopted concurrently with the respective waivers. We prepared an initial study and subsequent negative declaration to analyze the expansion of the grazing program to the Petaluma River watershed and to the west side of Point Reyes National Seashore under the new conditional waiver. To be clear, the CEQA analysis does not address the environmental impacts resulting from grazing itself, which are part of the baseline environmental conditions. Rather, the analysis addresses the potential environmental impacts of permit implementation in these new areas and concludes that the changes to the project will have a less than significant impact on the environment and that no mitigation measures are required. As part of conditional waiver development and the CEQA process, we conducted several forms of outreach and consultation beginning in late 2022. We convened a technical advisory committee with rangeland management professionals from North Bay agricultural support organizations, including resource conservation districts, University of California Extension, the National Resource Conservation Service, and the National Park Service. We conducted 5 separate meetings to receive their input on the conditional waiver, its requirements and implementation, and consider their feedback and recommendations during the conditional waiver development process. The Water Board conducted tribal outreach from June 2023 through February 2025. We sent letters to all tribes in the conditional waiver geographic area and received one request for tribal consultation from the Federated Indians of Greaton Rancheria. That process was opened with an initial meeting in August 2023 and successfully concluded in February 2025 with the addition of language to the Ranch Water Quality Plan checklist, reminding ranchers of the requirements to protect tribal cultural resources and sacred sites. The Water Board identified disadvantaged communities in the project area using guidance from the State Office of Public Participation and conducted outreach to local non-governmental organizations, North Bay counties, farm bureaus, resource conservation districts, UC Extension, and others to identify groups or individuals we should contact. Although we received responses in support of our outreach efforts and we conducted tribal engagement, we received no additional requests for disadvantaged community engagement. Lastly, the Water Board conducted public information events via online virtual meeting in March 2024 and again in person in June of 2024. Staff gave a presentation and an invited presenter from the Marin Resource Conservation District provided their perspective on the Water Board's 319H grant program. Both events were well attended. The main elements of the conditional waiver are listed here. Following enrollment, a ranch water quality plan must be prepared for each grazing operation. The plan identifies water pollutant sources, management practices, corrective actions, and an implementation schedule. Compliance monitoring requirements consist of visual monitoring of ranch and stream conditions during wet and dry seasons, residual dry matter monitoring, and effectiveness monitoring of management actions. Annual reporting of water quality conditions, corrective actions taken, and further actions needed to protect water quality is also required. Lastly, ranch visits by Water Board staff are conducted to verify conditional waiver compliance. The conditional waiver performance standards require dischargers to minimize the delivery of sediment, pathogens, mercury, and nutrients from grazing operations to surface waters through the implementation of management practices. There are three main water quality focus areas for management practice implementation on grazing operations. The first is sediment and erosion control, which focuses largely on three things. First, ranch roads, such as the through-cut road shown on the top right, where the road is below the grade or level of adjacent pasture lands. This can result in rainwater being confined to the road and channeled downslope, potentially causing rilling and gullying of the road surface. Sediment erosion control also focuses on pasture vegetation cover and unstable areas such as eroding stream banks or hillside gullies. Management practices for sediment erosion control include using appropriate methods to construct and maintain ranch roads, managing animal use areas through fencing, and strategic water supply placement on pasture lands. Manure and nutrient management actions focus on pathways for manure to enter the stream network and areas of livestock concentration in the watershed, such as corrals or a water supply trough, as seen in the lower photo on the right, where several beef cattle are drinking from a water trough. Lastly, stream corridor management practices focus on livestock access to streams and the riparian corridor. Stream corridor management practices include controlled animal crossings, riparian fencing, and seasonal flash grazing to control livestock access to the stream network while maintaining a healthy stream corridor. Next, I'll provide some specific examples of management practices. On the left, a water supply trough is placed in a pasture with no water supply. When adequate water supply is available, livestock can be more evenly distributed on the landscape, reducing the potential for overgrazing and its adverse effects on water quality. On the right, riparian exclusion fencing maintains a vegetated buffer between livestock and a stream corridor. This allows for controlled animal access to maintain and protect beneficial uses in the stream corridor, and is an example of a management practice that could be applied to meet the new riparian performance standard in the conditional waiver. A couple more examples. The left photo shows an example of a controlled stream crossing, which allows vehicles and livestock to cross a dry stream bed in a stable, armored location. Fencing on either side of the crossing prevents animal access into the stream and riparian areas. On the right, a recently gravel-rocked road is shown. A raised hump across the road, called a water bar, directs road runoff into the grassy area off the road, as shown by the arrows. Both the gravel running surface and the water bar reduce road surface erosion by both protecting the road surface and by directing water off the road when it rains. There are several elements to grazing program performance monitoring. Grazing program success targets evaluate whether the conditional waiver terms and conditions are being met by enrollees and also rely on stakeholder feedback and results from 319H grant management practice implementation on grazing operations. The grazing program is part of 8 total maximum daily load, or TMDL, implementation plans. TMDL performance monitoring includes data collection, monitoring programs, and periodic publication of water quality report cards to document TMDL progress. Grazing program performance is also evaluated through semi-annual and annual reporting to the US EPA, based on targets set every 5 years in the non-point source program implementation plan, and lastly, by supporting research studies. Water quality monitoring demonstrates the effectiveness of total maximum daily load, or TMDL, implementation actions, including grazing management practices. Here is an example of how monitoring has been used to evaluate the performance of the Tomales Bay pathogen TMDL. This bar chart shows monitoring results for average fecal coliform concentrations in the Tomales Bay watershed before and after the Tomales Bay pathogen TMDL was implemented in 2008. As part of TMDL implementation, requirements under the conditional waiver for grazing also began in 2008. The y-axis shows fecal coliform concentration and the x-axis shows data for each of the 16 sample sites. The water quality objective of 200 bacteria per 100 milliliters is also shown as a dashed horizontal line. The red bars show the average fecal coliform concentration at each of the 16 sample sites for a four-year period prior to TMDL implementation. The green bars show fecal coliform concentration during the 15 years after TMDL implementation. All the collected data meet the Water Board's quality assurance and quality control requirements. The TMDL identified six main pollutant sources for pathogens in the Tomales Bay watershed, namely agricultural runoff, faulty on-site sewage disposal systems, boat discharges, open space lands, municipal runoff, and small wastewater treatment facilities and sewage holding ponds. Although several pollutant sources, including grazing, contribute to the fecal coliform levels shown, I'd like to direct your attention to sites WS-11 through WS-16 that are circled along the x-axis on the lower right side of the bar chart. All these sites show a significant decline in fecal coliform concentrations when comparing pre- and post-TMDL implementation levels. These sites are located on Olema Creek, a tributary to Lagunitas Creek, where grazing operations are the predominant land use. Data from these monitoring sites and others on Olema Creek were found to support conclusions in a peer-reviewed published study that found improved managerial control of cattle access to streams through the implementation of grazing management practices resulted in statistically significant reductions in fecal coliform concentrations. We find these results persuasive and in support of the management practice-based approach taken by the conditional waiver. I'd also like to add our thanks to the Tomales Bay Watershed Council, now joined with the Tomales Bay Foundation, for their collaboration in collecting these monitoring data for many years now. Implementation of management practices is funded by U.S. EPA grants administered by the California Water Boards under Section 319H of the Federal Clean Water Act. To date, more than $4 million in 319H grants have been awarded for grazing operations as well as dairies in the North Bay region and well over 200 projects completed. The photo on the right shows a 319H grant-funded road improvement project currently underway in the Lagunitas Creek watershed. We will continue to prioritize and advocate for 319H grant funding to help ranchers pay for management practice implementation in the areas of waiver expansion. Like the examples I just showed, projects include exclusion fencing, water supply development, stream bed and bank stabilization, revegetation planting, and road and drainage improvements. Key partners for 319H grants have included local resource conservation districts, the National Park Service, and others. Here's an example of a 319H grant implementation project with photos showing conditions before and after project implementation. On the left, you can see a road leading downhill that has a small gully that has eroded part of the road. The road continues downhill where it crosses a stream. In this case, sediment eroded from the road is transported down the gully and directly into the stream during rain events. In addition, riparian vegetation along the stream corridor is largely absent due to disturbance from vehicle traffic. The photo on the right shows the same location after project completion. Notice the barn in the background for orientation in both photos. The disturbance associated with the road crossing the stream in the middle ground of the left photo has been remedied by a fence and vegetation planting in the disturbed area, as shown after project completion in the photo on the right. The road has also been regraded and gravel rocked to provide a stable, erosion-resistant running surface. The grazing permit and CEQA documents were made available for a 30-day public comment period, ending on March 24th of this year. We received 99 comment letters from 10 organizations and 89 private citizens. The majority of comments were directed at Point Reyes National Seashore. 76 letters were in support of the conditional waiver. Of these letters in support, 28 expressed unconditional support, whereas 48 letters expressed general support for the conditional waiver, but with suggested revisions. 17 comment letters were either opposed to the conditional waiver or opposed to any grazing at all. Comment letters in support of the conditional waiver expressed four key themes. First, that geographic expansion of the grazing program ensures more consistent watershed protection across the North Bay region. Second, supporters liked that the conditional waiver sets clear, consistent standards across all grazing operations. Third, that the conditional waiver aligns with other agency directives, including the Coastal Commission's conditional concurrence and the general management plan for Point Reyes National Seashore. Lastly, most comment letters in support of the conditional waiver made recommendations for improvements, which I'll go into next. Although we received many comment letters, specific comments and recommendations were frequently repeated and were primarily related to Point Reyes National Seashore and the Golden Gate National Recreation Area. As a result, our responses were typically directed at as many as 40 to 50 comments at one time. The more commonly requested revisions are listed here, and I'll go through each one individually. First, many commenters recommended that mandatory water quality sampling be added as a requirement of the conditional waiver. We explained that water quality sampling is already required in TMDL watersheds, including those regulated by the grazing program, to evaluate TMDL implementation plan progress on a watershed scale. We also explained in our response that site-specific water quality monitoring is not always necessary or preferred when assessing non-point sources of pollution, such as that from grazing lands, where pollutants are dispersed across large areas and discharge varies based on rainfall, soil type, topography, and other factors. However, we agree that water quality sampling is a key component to assessing program effectiveness, and that the terms and conditions of the conditional waiver should underscore the executive officer's authority to require site-specific monitoring and reporting when necessary, particularly when the Water Board observes noncompliance that results in or contributes to water quality impacts. As a result, we have added this as a new provision to the revised tentative order. Many commenters recommended that compliance and enforcement provisions in the conditional waiver be improved, with most comments focused on grazing operations at Point Reyes National Seashore. We disagreed that additional compliance and enforcement provisions were required. In our response to commenters, we explained that the Water Board verifies compliance with the conditional waiver through a combination of on-site inspections, review of annual monitoring reports, and evaluation of monitoring data. We explained our progressive enforcement policy and that the enforcement framework is consistent with the State Water Board's policy for implementation and enforcement of the Non-Point Source Pollution Control Program. Many commenters also recommended the addition or improvement of self-reporting requirements in the conditional waiver, although provided no further elaboration. Some commenters requested that the Water Board eliminate their reliance on self-reporting. We explained to these commenters that self-reporting is already a component of the terms and conditions of the conditional waiver, and that it requires two forms of self-reporting: an annual monitoring report, called an annual certification, and reporting of any spills or discharges that threaten human health or water quality. We also explained that the Water Board does not exclusively rely on self-reporting to ensure compliance, and referred these commenters to further information on self-reporting in our response to requests for improved compliance and enforcement provisions. Lastly, a commonly requested revision was to add specific requirements for management practices. For example, one commenter requested that the conditional waiver require a minimum 100-foot buffer zone between livestock and waterways. We explained why the conditional waiver does not require that specific management practices be universally implemented, but rather that it is the discharger's responsibility to assess their grazing operations and site conditions to select and implement appropriate management practices for their ranch. This gives the discharger flexibility in meeting the conditional waiver performance standards, in the most effective and efficient manner for their ranch. Moreover, California Water Code Section 13360 prohibits water board staff from specifying the design, location, type of construction, or particular manner of permit compliance. In addition to the more frequent comments, there were also comments concerned about the application of the conditional waiver to future grazing operations at Point Reyes, numeric limit requirements, designation of impaired streams at Point Reyes National Seashore, periodic review of the grazing program and public accountability, and one or two others. We responded to each of these comments and concluded that no additional changes were needed to the tentative order or CEQA document. Comment letters expressing opposition to the conditional waiver were primarily focused on Point Reyes National Seashore and divided into two groups. The first group misunderstood the use of the term grazing waiver, which is used as shorthand to refer to the conditional waiver. This group interpreted the term waiver as meaning that the Water Board was issuing a waiver of regulatory requirements for grazing operations. The second group opposed the conditional waiver in favor of waste discharge requirements, or WDRs, because they believe that WDRs have more stringent requirements than a conditional waiver. In our responses, we explain to these two groups why neither of these comments were correct. First, we explain that the conditional waiver is a type of permit that waives the need for waste discharge requirements if specific conditions are met. In this case, these conditions are designed to minimize and control discharges of animal waste and sediment to waters of the state and include evaluation of operating practices, identification of comprehensive site-specific pathogen and sediment control measures, development of a schedule for management plan implementation, and annual reporting on actions taken. Second, we explain that Water Code Section 13269 allows the Water Board to conditionally waive the need for waste discharge requirements if the waiver is consistent with applicable state and regional water quality control plans and is in the public interest. The conditional waiver is in the public interest because it offers a streamlined permitting approach that reduces the administrative burden of waste discharge requirements while maintaining regulatory requirements that are equally protective of water quality. This makes the conditional waiver a more appropriate and efficient permitting tool for regulating grazing operations than waste discharge requirements. Lastly, one commenter stated that the CEQA analysis was inappropriate due to ongoing water pollution from grazing animals and a lack of evidence that proposed management measures will address the issues. We explain that the CEQA analysis does not address the environmental impacts resulting from grazing itself, which are part of the baseline environmental conditions, but rather that the analysis addresses the potential environmental impacts of permit implementation in these new areas and concludes that the changes to the project will have a less than significant impact on the environment and that no mitigation measures are required. Please note, however, that we believe the conditional waiver will improve water quality. In summary, the initial study and subsequent negative declaration analyzed the potential environmental impacts of expanding the current grazing program to include the Petaluma River watershed and the west side of Point Reyes National Seashore in the new conditional waiver, and concludes that the changes to the grazing program would have no significant impact on the environment. The tentative resolution, the first item before you, would adopt the initial study and subsequent negative declaration. The second item before you, the conditional waiver, proposes to renew the existing conditional waivers, which have a demonstrated history of success in managing water pollution from grazing operations, and to apply the same approach to the geographic area of expansion, all in one permit that is consistently applied throughout the North San Francisco Bay Area. Thank you. That concludes my presentation, and I'm available for questions from the board.
Thank you so much. I have a suggestion of how we proceed. Given the extensive comments and the long work on this, I wanted to first, though, thank our team, Chuck and Xavier, Lori, Renee. Thank you for all your work on this. I'd like to ask the board if there are any questions. Then I'd like to take public comments And then I'd like to take any board comments, and then we can turn to our executive officer for her recommendation. So are there any questions for Renee? Go ahead.
Just two quick questions. The fecal coliform data that you presented, that is fecal coliform from any mammal, is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. And then you mentioned the challenges of overgrazing, but I also know that we're like trying to move towards, if I understand the term correctly, mob grazing. And is it possible to give me a quick rundown of how we implement mob grazing but not result in overgrazing?
I haven't heard the term mob grazing myself. However, I imagine that might be related or akin to flash grazing, where
you're moving through multiple paddocks. Yeah.
That sounds like flash grazing.
Yeah. And flash grazing is different than overgrazing because...
And of course, I'm not a certified rangeland manager, but...
Farther away from that than you are, I can assure you that.
So I'll say that first. Secondly, flash grazing is used in a variety of situations. So one of the more higher profile situations that's been in the public a lot the last few years is for fuel reduction for wildfire, potential wildfire control. So that fuel reduction effort, you'll see, you know, sheep grazing along highways to cut the grasses down and that sort of thing. So that's one example. Another, and that does not result in overgrazing because the livestock are released for a certain period of time. They reduce the fuel load, but there's plenty of vegetation remaining to provide adequate cover for erosion control. Another example would be flash grazing used in the riparian corridor, where livestock are released under certain circumstances, under certain conditions, to graze and manage growth in the riparian corridor. And that is also used for wildfire control. But in addition to that, it can be used to manage invasives, to clean out the riparian corridor using herbivory rather than other methods. And that contributes to a lot of the ecosystem needs that the riparian corridor has. There's a lot of moving parts to that. So I'm not sure if that helps. Okay.
Questions?
Mark. Just a couple quick ones. First of all, excellent presentation.
Thank you.
Second one, I hadn't focused on it before, but the mercury monitoring, is that just background or are there some old residual mining operations in the area?
Walker Creek had a large mercury mine in it.
Okay, makes sense. Huh? And then the second one, you know, I think it's called the Ranch Water Quality Management Plans.
Correct. Yeah.
So when I looked at the templates for those, I mean, those look really good, and you're collecting a lot of data. Is there any sort of on an annual basis best practice sharing amongst the various ranchers? You know, if you see somebody doing something really good with one of these plans, you know, incorporate that, share that. So
I am not aware of a formal annual meeting where ranch water quality practices are discussed among ranchers. However, there is a very strong network of agricultural support organizations in the North Bay that includes rangeland professionals at the resource conservation districts, the National Resource Conservation Service, University of California Cooperative Extension has experts that are professionals in rangeland management, and that is a mechanism through which the information is shared within that community. When someone from the RCD, the Resource Conservation District, goes out to help someone prepare a ranch water quality plan, for example, they will share the knowledge that they have gained by visiting all the other ranches and implementing 319H grant projects as another example. So that information does have a mechanism to be shared in the community for sure.
Perfect. Thank you.
Sure.
If I may, could we now take public comments for those in the room, and then we'll check as to whether there are any Zoom. Julie, do you want to proceed?
Yes, we have four in-person speakers today. We'll start with Woody Elliott, followed by Morgan Tade, Scott Webb, and then Elizabeth Dodge.
Thank you. Thank you. And thanks to each of you for coming to our hearing in person. We really appreciate it.
Hello. I am Woody Elliott, and I took the oath to tell the truth. Speaking on behalf of the Tomales Bay Foundation, a nonprofit that develops collaborative stewardship and educational projects to protect, monitor, and enhance the Tomales Bay ecosystem. We support the continuation of the Conditional Grazing Waiver Program and its expansion into the western portion of Point Reyes National Seashore. The waiver program encourages ranchers to implement best management practices that further the board's TMDL goals for reducing pathogens, sediment, nutrients, and mercury, and surface runoff from agricultural operations. For the past several years, the foundation has been monitoring fecal coliform levels in the Tomales Bay watershed in cooperation with regional board staff and the Rose Foundation. We have noted periodic exceedances of fecal coliform levels for recreational contact at several sites and encourage their remediation by upstream operators. At our request, your board staff has indicated a willingness to analyze and report to you and the public on the efficacy of the modified grazing waiver program to implement BMPs and reduction of TMDLs. We heartily endorse the staff commitment to learn and therefore improve how the operation of ranchers, regulations of agencies, and interests of the public foster the environmental health of Sonoma and Marin counties. Please continue, expand, and monitor the success of the Conditional Grazing Waiver Program, which will help sustain the vitality of our environment. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Elliott, and thank you for working with our team. Next.
Thank you. There you go. Good morning. My name is Morgan Toddy. I'm a legal and policy intern with the Environmental Action Committee of West Marin, and I took the oath. Our mission is to protect and sustain the unique lands, waters, and biodiversity of West Marin, and I'm here today representing approximately 1,200 members of our Point Reyes Station-based organization. We submitted written comments back in March expressing our general support for the proposed conditional waiver, and the Water Board staff responded to many of our suggested revisions, so I'll keep my comments today brief. Overall, we support the adoption of the revised tentative order, and we are eager to have a consistent regulatory structure in the Point Reyes National Seashore. First, we would like to thank the Water Board staff for considering our recommendations, including revising the tentative order. In particular, we were pleased to see the addition of Provision 6H related to compliance monitoring and reporting, which emphasizes the executive officer's authority to require additional monitoring and reporting where necessary, and we believe this is a critical component of an effective order. We would also like to stress the importance of public outreach in achieving successful implementation of the renewed conditional waiver, and we appreciate that the Water Board plans to hold events like educational workshops for ranchers to learn more about ranch water quality plans. We plan to amplify these events locally. In addition to education, environmental groups and community members are supporting the Water Board's efforts by conducting water quality monitoring. EAC coordinates with Marin County Environmental Health Services and the National Park Service to conduct water sampling at Drake's Beach and Drake's Estero, and we will continue our monitoring efforts. To complement the Water Board's regulatory program, EAC and other groups plan to report any violations directly to the Water Board, and we're appreciative of the system in place to do this. Lastly, we understand that the Water Board has limited resources. However, for this program to be truly effective, we ask that the board prioritize conducting more frequent inspections to ensure compliance and promote public transparency by making all related documents available online for public review. Thank you for carefully considering our comments and suggestions. We look forward to working with the board on implementing the conditional waiver program and helping to ensure compliance in the seashore. Thank you.
Thank you so much for coming today and your comments and for the role of your organization in this endeavor. Welcome.
Welcome. Good morning, Chair, members of the Board. This is Scott Webb, Director of Advocacy with the Resource Renewal Institute. I'm here to voice our organization's support for the conditional waiver with no recommendations. First, we'd like to express our gratitude and congratulations to Water Board staff. This was no easy undertaking, and we are grateful for all their hard work to protect water quality in North Bay. Second, we'd also like to ask that the Water Board continue to work with regulatory agencies and their water quality management regimes for the seashore and maintain the ability to be adapted if water quality is not improving. We look forward to working with staff on protecting North Bay water quality and urge this board to approve the conditional waiver. Thanks for the opportunity to comment.
Thank you, Mr. Webb, and thank you for coming in person. Welcome.
Hello, my name is Elizabeth Dodge. The proposed conditional waiver of waste discharge requirements consists of reporting of visual observations by potential polluters using these little four-page checklists, and this has two obvious limitations. First of all, self-reporting, like the fox guarding the hen house, is unlikely to result in honest, unbiased results. Secondly, pollutants, like pathogenic bacteria and nutrients, are not visible to the naked eye. So ignoring the fact that livestock grazing operators have no incentive to accurately report problems, and regional board enforcement appears to be mostly statements on paper, the management practices themselves, although they may reduce contaminants, are often not sufficient to meet the basin plan water quality criteria. To illustrate this, I offer the complaints inspection reports at dairies at Point Reyes National Seashore conducted by your own staff in February of 2022. Now, your staff are very qualified and have no bias, and they identified five or more action items for the dairies that they inspected. And although not documented, I have no doubt these action items were implemented because the National Park Service paid for it out of their own budget. This is something that without financial support, a lot of for-profit businesses would not gladly do. So a year later, in 2023, the National Park Service conducted their annual water quality monitoring. This was done at the request of the California Coastal Commission, who had the scientific integrity to ask the Park Service to document impacts from grazing. In this report, they found widespread exceedances of E. coli, not just during the rainy season, but it was even more widespread and worse when they were sampling in July and August. That's because there was no rainfall to dilute the ongoing discharge of waste to the surface waters at Point Reyes. Which brings us to the biggest question. Why are you offering these even conditional waste discharge waivers to businesses with a documented long history of grossly polluting our streams? It might ease your conscience if most of the grazing operations at Point Reyes close next year as planned, but several grazing operations will remain, and there are 100 or more other grazing operations like it throughout your regulatory region. So, Point Reyes did give us this insight into how livestock companies contaminate with impunity, and these proposed conditional waivers are unlikely to help us meet water quality standards as laid out in the basin plan. Thank you.
Ms. Dodge, I appreciate you coming and your perspective. Thank you. Is there anything that the staff would like to add before I take board member comments?
I just want to clarify.
Introduce yourself first.
I'm sorry, Lori Tall. I just want to clarify, Ms. Dodge referenced the checklist as a reporting mechanism, and that checklist in our order is there as a guidance document for the ranchers to assess their facility and create their ranch plans. The annual certification form and the annual reporting process is much different than that checklist.
Which is in our materials on site, yes. And it was in the board meeting packets. Thank you for clarifying that, Lori. Xavier, do you want to add anything?
And we also don't just rely on the annual reports. We do have an inspection program in which we respond to complaints, and also we go out to sites, and we prioritize that because of our limited resources. But we use things like topography and history of compliance and figure out where we go to inspect, as well as with the complaints. So it's not just the reporting. We have more comprehensive compliance program than that.
Plus the monitoring data itself.
We do have monitoring. The monitoring data is really monitoring the TMDL as a whole, so there's multiple sources that are coming from it. On Point Reyes National Seashore, we are cooperating and working with the Seashore on their monitoring program, and we'd like to work with some of the environmental NGOs on their monitoring program so that it meshes well with the Seashores in order to get a comprehensive understanding of pathogens.
Thank you. Let me turn to my right. Are there board member comments?
I just want to congratulate the staff and all of those who participate in this. The word stakeholders is sometimes dreadfully overused in our world, but when it comes to grazing at Point Reyes, it is not. And I think there are a lot of people that have a big stake in this, and that has been true for a long time. And I'm just so pleased that so many people have been able to work together to improve the situation, even if it's not perfect in everybody's eyes yet. This is a huge, huge a step forward, and I'm really glad that our staff and our organization has played a part in that.
Thank you. I appreciate those of you who came in person. I haven't checked whether there are commenters on the Zoom platform.
No commenters on the Zoom platform.
Thank you. My error. There was an extraordinary amount of engagement that was very interesting to read about and is reinforced by the discussion, both the presentation from our team here and those of you who've come in person. I think that receiving 99 comment letters shows such a strong interest in the details of how we move forward. And as Xavier noted, I'm really hopeful that we continue to align and blend the non-governmental organization and voluntary monitoring efforts with what is happening by Park Service and with our own work. So let's look to that as we move forward to make that harmonize. I was very glad that we had the 2022 Technical Advisory Committee and the extensive participation there. I was grateful for the tribal engagement and that resulted in the conversation that led to the work that we are doing. So the consistent regulation by including the National Park Service operations to me, the consistent regulation across a very large acreage, I think for me is so persuasive, and I plan to support this. And with no further ado, Eileen, would you give us your recommendation?
Sure, and we're going to break it into two separate items. So I'll first give the recommendation for item 5A. I recommend the board adopt item 5A, the resolution for adoption of a California Environmental Quality Act initial study and subsequent negative declaration for the conditional waiver of waste discharge requirements for grazing operations.
May I please have a motion and a second?
Yes, you have a motion.
Thank you, Letty. And a second?
Second.
Thank you, Andy. We have a motion by Board Member Bielan and a second by Board Member Gunther. Julie, would you please call the roll?
Board Member Ransom.
Aye.
Board Member Bielan.
Aye.
Board Member Gunther.
Aye.
Vice Chair Young.
Aye.
Chair Hacker.
Aye. Thank you very much. Let's move to your recommendation for item 5B.
Thank you. So I recommend the board adopt item 5B, the conditional waiver of waste discharge requirements for grazing operations in the North San Francisco Bay region, including the Napa River, Sonoma Creek, Petaluma River, and Tamales Bay watershed, and all grazing operations in Point Reyes National Seashore.
May I please have a motion and a second?
A motion here.
Moved by Board Member Bielan
and second.
Seconded by Board Member Gunther. Would you please call the vote?
I'm sorry, the second was
by Gunther, Board Member Gunther?
And not Vice Chair Young. I think
no.
It was Vice Chair Young. No?
It was by, excuse me, let me correct myself. It was by Board Member Ransom. Was it you? I shall look up next time. I'm running out of board members. Okay. I correct that it was seconded by Vice Chair Young. Thank you. Would you call the vote?
Board Member Ransom.
Aye.
Board Member Bielan.
Aye.
Board Member Gunther.
Aye.
Vice Chair Young.
Aye.
And Chair Hacker.
Aye. This item is adopted, and I thank all of you who came to participate, and I thank our team for their extensive work on this matter. Very well. We're turning to item 6, Eileen, the San Francisco Bay Regional Monitoring Program. If you wish, we could just stand for a couple of minutes for those of you who don't wish to remain, and we'll start again in just 2 minutes. Item 6.
Great. Thank you. This informational item will provide an update on the San Francisco Bay Regional Monitoring Program, also known as the RMP. The RMP was created by the San Francisco Bay Regional Water Board in 1993 to ensure water quality management decisions and investments are guided by sound science. The RMP is a collaborative of regulators, dischargers, industry representatives, non-governmental organizations, and scientists. San Francisco Estuary Institute, also known as SFEI, has managed the monitoring program and conducted the studies needed to assist leaders in developing science-based policies and regulations. Today, we're joined by Amy Kleckner, SFEI RMP Manager, and Jay Davis, SFEI RMP Lead Scientist, and they will provide a summary of recent findings on contaminants of emerging concern in bay fish, sediment management, and RMP efforts to provide information to support the Water Board with the upcoming mercury and PCB total maximum daily load revision projects. Thank you. Go ahead, Amy.
Welcome, Amy and Jay. It's lovely to have you here. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Hacker and board members. I thank you for the introduction. I'll just go ahead and get started. There we go. Thank you. So the goal of the RMP is to collect data and communicate information about water quality in San Francisco Bay in support of management decisions. The RMP shares combined support, direction, and participation by regulated agencies and regulated organizations in a model of collective responsibility. The program, now in its 32nd year, has an average of 68 entities that participate, and that number will fluctuate based on the number of dredgers paying into the program each year. Our work groups and strategy teams serve as the basis of this of a bottom-up planning process by meeting as needed to develop long-term RMP study plans that address high-priority topics. We are nearing the end of the annual process of selecting pilot and special studies for 2026. The work groups met in the spring to review, discuss, and rank the special studies they were proposing. Those recommended proposals and their rankings, as determined by the work groups, were shared with the Technical Review Committee in June, who then have the responsibility of, who had the responsibility of determining a full complement of studies from all of the work groups, which will then be brought to the steering committee in August to be approved for 2026 funding. In 2024, the budget for the RMP was roughly $4 million, with about a third of that budget going to special studies, a third for status and trends monitoring, and a third for program management activities. In 2025, this year, The RMP budget doubled to just over $8 million, thanks to a non-competitive grant award from the U.S. EPA San Francisco Bay Program Office to support the RMP. That grant has a title called Tracking Bay Health. So Tracking Bay Health is a joint RMP and nutrient management strategy project to support the program goals and management questions over a five-year period, so 2025 through 2029. The overall five-year request for the grant was $23.5 million. The first allotment that the RMP received is $6 million. That was awarded in December of last year. We have yet to be allocated the remaining $17.5 million for the RMP. We requested it an additional $11 million from the EPA's fiscal year 25 budget to complete our work plan through 2027. We are still optimistically waiting for that to come through. That money would support additional special studies in 2026, work to support PCB TMDL studies, a fixed station watershed monitoring network, and watershed dynamic modeling. Here is some of what we've planned with that first allotment of funds that we received in December for 2025 and 2026. A lot of what we have spent so far has been getting ourselves set up to use the funds, a separate Tracking Bay Health Quality Assurance Program plan needed to be written and submitted to the EPA that has been approved by the EPA. We did a request for qualifications review for laboratory analyses before we could begin contracting, and we just this past week completed that work. So now we're full steam ahead, and some of the highlights include improving our communications plan implementation. So not just what the RMP already does, but what the RMP does already do, but even better, and in the case of special studies, even more. In for status and trends monitoring for 2025, we have a water cruise this summer planned. We'll be able to do non-target analysis of contaminants of emerging concern at all 22 stations we'll be hitting, thanks to these Tracking Bay Health funds. And we're hoping to get some improved methods developed for CECs that we're looking to monitor as well, things like bisphenols and organophosphate esters. In 2025, there were 14 special studies funded in addition to the 11 that were funded directly by the RMP. So this is what I'm like to call our 25 and 25. So we are we have kicked off 25 special studies this year. So there's a lot of work going on, and there will be a lot to see in the next few years on that. We every year the Regional Monitoring Program puts out a multi-year plan. This document gets updated annually, and the purpose of the document is to guide efforts and summarize plans developed within the RMP. So every November, we hold a workshop to discuss and review the priorities and identify priority information needs. Page 6 of the document has this table that gets updated annually, and that lists all the priority management drivers. The RMP also issues a report each year, the RMP update in odd years, and the pulse of the Bay in even years. Work is currently underway on the 2025 RMP update, and plans are to distribute it at our annual meeting on October 15th at the David Brower Center in Berkeley, and I hope you all can make it. Excuse me. Now on to some of the highlights from recent studies. A recent highlight of our Contaminants of Emerging Concern work was a publication of a journal article on an expanded data set for PFAS, also known as forever chemicals, in bay fish. California does not have thresholds, but concentrations have frequently exceeded the thresholds established by other states. This report generated a lot of interest and media coverage. That was that. The mission of the sediment work group has been busy as well. The mission of the sediment work group is to basically provide science to inform sediment management. I'm going to give a quick overview on some of the work they've been doing. We have several current studies, some which launched this year. The shoreline change in San Francisco Bay is one that started just recently, as well as refining the sediment conceptual models for Suisun Bay and San Pablo Bay. At the recent sediment work group meeting, findings from USGS research on tidal marsh and sediment dynamics was presented by USGS colleagues. The findings were that the physical characteristics of the marsh did matter and that there is considerable seasonal and regional variability. And then the sediment management focus over the next 5 years is to develop those integrated conceptual understandings of dynamics at the sub-embayment scale, so starting with Suisun and San Pablo Bay. Hopefully the next up would be Central Bay. And then monitoring sediment transport and deposition dynamics at a range of marsh sites. Modeling sediment transport and deposition dynamics at different spatial and regional scales, or temporal scales as well. And now I'm going to turn it over to Jay.
Thank you, Amy. Welcome, Jay.
Good morning, Chair Hacker and board members. So now we're bringing in the old timer to talk about RMP work on legacy contaminants. Informing management is what the RMP is all about, as Amy described. Two of the key management plans for the Bay are coming up for revision, the mercury and PCB TMDLs. For both of these contaminants, concentrations in fish tissue are identified in the TMDLs as the crucial indicator of the status of condition in the Bay. I've been leading the RMP fish monitoring since it began in the 90s, back around the time that board member Dr. Gunther was working on the RMP. The fish monitoring has included thorough monitoring of mercury and PCBs throughout the bay. For mercury, the key indicator species is striped bass. For striped bass, in addition to RMP data, we have earlier data going back to the early 1970s. This graph shows bars that indicate the average concentrations for striped bass for each year, and the points indicate the individual samples. And the data are compared to the water quality objective, which is in the pink line of 20 parts per billion. Point two parts per million. And then also shown are advisory tissue levels, which are thresholds that the Office of Environmental Health Hazard Assessment uses in development of fish consumption advisories. So the average concentration for striped bass is hovered right around the 0.44 part per million mark, which is the no consumption threshold for the sensitive population of women of childbearing age and children, which is why we have very strict consumption advice for striped bass in the bay for that population, and the mean is well above the water quality objective. So also this graph importantly is showing the long-term time series, which indicates that we've seen no evidence of decline over this 50-year time span. As we like to do in the RMP, we've convened a group of stakeholders and scientists called the Mercury Strategy Team to discuss information needs, develop study plans, and provide oversight for studies in the lead up to the revision of the Mercury TMDL. To kick off these discussions, the Water Board staff shared a thoughtful list of information needs that would support the update. The list on this slide covers most of the Water Board items. A synthesis of information that's been generated in recent years is the main item, And there are a number of components to that that have to do with loadings of mercury, getting, you know, pulling together the latest information on loadings of mercury from different pathways, concentrations in the bay, which indicate status and trends, and then the data that are needed to make forecasts of recovery. The other items on the list represent new work that will be conducted by next summer's cutoff for new information for the TMDL, including additional rounds of data on mercury in fish and sediment, and work on upgraded models to support an updated mass budget for the bay and to forecast recovery trajectories. The graph I'm showing here was created by Richard Looker back around the time of the original TMDL. It was based on a very simple modeling approach, and this same sort of approach was used for PCBs and the PCB TMDL. But we're developing a more sophisticated, realistic, and robust model for contaminant fate in the bay now, and we'll be able to use this model for mercury, PCBs, and other contaminants, as well as modeling sediment itself. For PCBs, the key indicator species is Shiner surf perch. This graph shows the latest data from the sampling in 2019. We did sample again last year, and we're working on analyzing those samples now, so we'll have another round of data for 2024. And this is in contrast to the other graph, which was showing the long-term time series. This is just showing different locations in the bay and the concentrations that we've observed at these locations. And again, the bars are averages, and the dots are showing individual samples. The individual samples are actually composites, though, so they're representing 20 fish in each dot. We do that to save money on the expense of analysis. So as for mercury, concentrations are still well above the TMDL target, which is the line that's closest to zero there, the kind of purple line, 10 parts per billion. And then the red line shows the no consumption advisory tissue level from OEHA. And again, a lot of our concentrations are above the no consumption threshold and way above the TMDL target. Unlike mercury, there are some possible signs of long-term decline for PCBs, but overall the rate of decline in the bay is slow at best, and continued monitoring is needed for a definitive assessment. In contrast to mercury, localized spatial variation is important for PCBs, as these data show. The RMP fish data point to specific priority margin areas like San Leandro Bay and Richmond Harbor that are shown here that have the highest degree of impairment. We've done some preliminary modeling that suggests that significant reductions of stormwater loads to some of these areas, these priority margin areas, would lead to recovery in a 10 or 20 year time span. So we're also planning and implementing a series of PCB studies to support the revision of that TMDL. We've got another group of stakeholders and scientists that we've convened, the PCB work group, to discuss the information needs, develop study plans, and provide oversight for the studies. As for mercury, the Water Board gave us a list of the information needs to support the update of the TMDL. And this slide covers most of the Water Board items. As for mercury, a synthesis of recent information is a key item on the list. The other items listed are similar to those for mercury, with one major difference, and that is for PCBs, the focus is on understanding recovery in the priority margin areas. Another difference for PCBs is something that Amy showed earlier, is that we're hoping to obtain a substantial boost in funding, $2 million from that next allotment of funds from the Tracking Bay Health proposal. Okay, so that concludes our brief update of a very large body of work that we're doing in the RMP. We always appreciate the opportunity to present RMP information to the Water Board. It helps us fulfill our mission to provide information on Bay water quality to the water quality decision makers. And Amy and I are available to provide more information to Water Board staff and the Water Board and the public at any time, and we'd be happy to take any questions now.
Well, thanks, Jay. Thank you, Amy. There may be a host of questions, and I'm so glad you mentioned the October 15th RMP annual meeting. I'll start with Board Member Gunther.
Yeah, always great to hear about the progress of the RMP. I want to take just a moment to acknowledge the extraordinary service to this program and to the Bay in general from the work of Dr. Davis over the last 40. You're coming up on your 40th anniversary at SFEI, aren't you? And it's really, and just seeing that little graphic that showed Richard Looker, 2008, we have we've gained extraordinary benefits from people being involved for so long, including you, Chair Hacker, and I guess me as well. And it's really led to this development of this program and of SFAI in general. And I think this is a treasure that we all need to really appreciate. And I think the RMP can be a model as we work towards sea level rise issues, that there's a model for having, you know, us not argue about what the data is, but just argue about what we should do about it. And the quality of the work that's been done. And Amy, I'm not sure which, how many RMP managers there have been, but as the first one, I can say it's great to see that the program is still in such capable hands. Just a couple questions. The surf perch data, is that, what tissue is being analyzed there?
The surf perch are small, and they're hard to dissect the muscle out, so we analyze them whole without the heads, tails, and gut contents.
They're in the basomatic.
Almost basomatic. We do remove certain parts. Yeah.
Great. And the I think it's important to remember, and you can see this in a very important publication, the Marine Pollution Bulletin from 1998, but when PCBs were eliminated in use, there was a significant response in the bioaccumulation data in San Francisco Bay. But that was a huge step down, and the situation we have now is something that I think we anticipated, which is that the remaining contamination, it takes only a little inflow to maintain the tissue concentrations that we see. Would that be your interpretation as well?
Yes. The inputs are continuing, and like the priority margin area that we've studied the most is San Leandro Bay. And our preliminary modeling that we're working on improving suggests that if we could really reduce the inputs significantly, that area would recover fairly quickly. By quickly, I'm 10 or 20 years, which is quick for a legacy contaminant. So there's more than a little still coming in. We see pretty high concentrations coming in from certain tributaries into these margin areas.
And is it still the conceptual model that those inputs are the result of runoff from a relatively small number of highly contaminated land parcels?
Yeah.
And in
but there are, I mean, it is from highly contaminated parcels, whether it's, you know, whether you would call it a small number or, you know, there's a fair number of these source areas around in our watersheds. Mm-hmm. The more we look, I think we keep finding more.
How unfortunate. Okay, thank you.
Yeah, just a general question. And first, thanks for including data from the year I was born. I didn't figure in the 70s, who knew? And this is actually just more of a general question. I think I know the answer, but and Andy just touched on it, which is There are areas of high concentration and runoff, but also we don't know what's happening in the future. You're indicating if we were to reduce the storm runoff and give it 20 years, it could recover, which is great, but we don't really know that's really the case. So are we really more advocating for active mitigation of contaminants, or is that still sort of beyond where we are right now in the study phase? Just a general.
I'm sorry, for what?
Are we actually expecting to advocate for active mitigation of the contaminants, or again, would you said reducing storm runoff and waiting 20 years, maybe we see some recovery, maybe we wouldn't. But with development happening and we can't really see in the future, I thought maybe more of an active mitigation maybe what we're looking as a conclusion. Does that make sense?
Yeah. The pace of change without major active mitigations in the areas that we've been studying has been very slow. So San Leandro Bay remains high as it has throughout our the period of record that we have. So whatever it takes to significantly reduce what's coming in from the tributaries is what would be needed to reduce concentrations in the fish in San Leandro Bay. Redevelopment is something that's happening, and that can kind of pave over areas that have been historically contaminated. The stormwater agencies are doing in the contaminated site. The agencies that are managing contaminated sites are doing things to reduce loads from source areas, but to date we haven't seen the reductions that would result in the fish really declining.
Richard, I can maybe add to that a little bit. I would say that the permit program that is going to be most heavily involved with this is the stormwater program, and so the we're on our third iteration of the municipal regional permit, MERP, and we've learned a lot in terms of how PCBs are distributed in the landscape. And one of the notable findings is you find PCBs at high concentrations, mainly in old industrial areas. And so this watershed that Jay was talking about that drains to San Leandro Bay is kind of a prime example of this. It's an old industrial area, there's a GE parcel there. There are other places where PCBs were used in electrical equipment. There are metal recyclers. So this watershed has lots of potential source areas. And then the other thing that's happened, with PCBs being used going back decades, is that the cows have left the barn to some extent, and so there could be sort of a moderate level of PCBs contamination, not necessarily associated with a specific parcel, but kind of generally. So the third iteration of the MERP recognized that, and so there's a focus area on old industrial areas sort of in two respects. One is that we want the countywide programs to continue looking, especially in old industrial areas, for source properties where they're, you can kind of do some management intervention before it escapes, and distributes. And then also attack those kind of moderately contaminated areas in old industrial land use where that, cow has left the barn kind of problem has happened. And, you don't have the screaming high concentrations, but still high enough where it would merit attention. And so I think these types of efforts will continue, and also doing a better job on things like when you demolish a building of a certain vintage where there were PCBs used in the building materials, like the caulks and window sealants, there's opportunity there to make sure that you don't have a release when you do the demolition. So getting better at those kinds of things is sort of the name of the game for PCBs, of avoiding catastrophes and doing that investigation to try to find the remaining sources in the watersheds, especially in old industrial areas. Okay.
Thank you, Richard. I've lost track of how we communicate, we writ large, I suppose, the risks to those subsistence anglers about levels of striped bass and surf perch consumption. And I think of almost any time I'm out on Albany Bulb or Point Isabel, there's someone coming in with a bucket with a huge striper that they're taking home to eat. And I'm wondering, where do people encounter some of the health advisory OEHA like, or is it even in other languages, or where do they find it? Do you have a sense of that?
I do have a sense. I don't have extensive knowledge or awareness of how this is implemented, but there are advisory signs that have been, the content has been developed by OEHA, and it's been over the years that they've refined it, and I think it's gotten better and better, that the way that they present the information on posters for the different populations. And so the content is there, but it's up to local authorities to actually postings. And I'm not extensively around the bay at fishing sites, but I do see the signs around the bay. Sometimes, I was recently in the downtown Vallejo area on the shoreline there, and they had the wrong sign. It was a sign for coastal fish when this was an estuary location. So there is posting. I think there's probably a lot of room for improvement, but it's up to local authorities to actually do the posting.
Yeah. I wonder also when someone purchases a multi-day or annual license, I wonder to what extent that information is available at the time of the license transaction. I'll try and figure that out myself. I'm worried about funding. There's a remarkable history that you and others are responsible for in building SFEI's monitoring program, and I'm hopeful that we can continue in a robust way, and I'm just worried about what a significant uncertainty and or budget cut will mean in operational terms, but we will table that for now and hope for the best. But I want to thank both of you for your investment in this and how much it means to the underpinning of so much of the work that our board does. So thank you.
Well, thanks again for the opportunity to share information.
Glad you were here. Anything further? If not, we're heading toward adjourning our meeting. No correspondence was received at this meeting, and the board is not meeting in closed session today. I'd like to thank our attorneys who are here, Yuri Wan and Chech Sablan. I'd like to thank AGP, who helps us make this a hybrid meeting. David, Dakota, and Andrew, thank you for your reliability. This concludes the public session of the July 9th, 2025 San Francisco Bay Regional Water Quality Control Board meeting. Thank you very much for joining us. We do appreciate your engagement in our work. Our next meeting is here on August 13th. We're adjourned.